You're listening to Coloring Outside the Memos with myself, Dr. Tiffany Monique Quash, and Dr. Lizzie Bartelt, a podcast about all things qualitative research. Thanks for listening and enjoy the episode. Cheers.
Hello, you all, and welcome back to Coloring Outside the Memos. I am Dr. Lizzie Bartelt, or Dr. Lizzie, as I think I went by in the last episode. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm here with...
I am Dr. Tiffany Monique Quash, or Dr. Tiffany, and I use she, her pronouns as well. And welcome.
Welcome. We're back for another episode, and we're so excited. So what are we talking about today, Dr. Tiffany?
So our topic today, topic time, it's today, how does qualitative research remain relevant in the quantitative world?
Ooh.
We're excited. So our purpose today is really to not have a comprehensive understanding of quantitative research because we're qualitative researchers. I mean, quant is not our thing. But some of the questions or comments we've received is like, what's the point of qualitative research? People lie about their experiences. So aren't numbers more reliable? Totally such a quantitative word. FYI, you might find me going back to qualitative, when I should be saying quantitative. We're not here to demonize quantitative research. Dr. Lizzie, what are some words or comments that you've heard about qualitative research from quantitative people?
Such a good question. So one of the things that I have heard from people is like, well, qualitative research just takes too long, or it's not really scientific though, right? Or you're just talking to people. So how is that science? I think those are some of the main things I've heard from people. Yeah, maybe not as rigorous. That's another one that comes up from time to time.
Yeah, not as rigorous. Definitely have gotten that one. So I think what I really wanted us to do to start this particular episode off was using our qualitative brains, thinking about how to define quantitative research. And a response in answering that question, the difference between qualitative and quantitative research noted by O'Dwyer and Browner in their text, Quantitative Research for the Qualitative Researcher, is to conceptualize the quantitative and qualitative traditions by using different primary symbol systems, numbers versus words, in pursuit of the same goal of discovering knowledge promotes cognitive outcomes, as noted by Vygotsky. Again, if I butchered your name, I'm super sorry. There's another text by Grotzen. Again, I'm so sorry about this. But the introduction to qualitative research and data, Melissa states, in the most basic terms, quantitative research methods are concerned with collecting and analyzing data that is structured and can be represented numerically. One of the central goals is to build accurate and reliable measures that allow for statistical analysis. So I don't know how I feel about even those two statements, but Lizzie, how would you define quantitative research? And how have you used quantitative research in the past? Or have you used quantitative research in the past?
Great questions. So how I would define it, I like both of those definitions and that they're both like trying to get to this idea of... kind of like the little anecdote I gave in the last episode that quant is N with spelled with an N and is about numbers, and qual is an L and it's about language. And so like, I think both of them are trying to get to that numeric understanding. And I think that's true. How I tend to define quant is the who, the what, and the where questions. And I think that is really important, right? One of the examples I give my students a lot when I tell them about this is, since the 1990s, the numbers of people having the number of adults who report regular sexual intercourse has gone way down. Okay, so that's an interesting thing, right? And we might look at that and go, well, why does anyone need to know that outside of sexual health, right? People are probably like, why in the heck does that even matter at all? Well, it matters because when we bring in qual and we ask the how and the why questions, why has that number gone down? Well, because more people can report domestic violence and intimate partner violence. More people can report sexual assault now and get out of relationships that they don't want to be in. The age of marriage has gone up, meaning people are getting married later and they're getting married to people that they want to be married to. We're having more productive conversations about libido and differences in who wants to have sex and when they want to have sex. So all of these things are actually really important, right? Because that quant number that is just a number we can define and understand with qualitative research. And I think we can, in somewhat with quant research too, right? We can understand how those numbers are based on other research. And so research reinforces research, reinforces research, reinforces research. And I love that. It makes my brain explode with happy. So when I think about quant research that I have done, it's, I've done some work on like what prevalence data of sexual activity there is, like kissing, cuddling, and massage, which is just a nice happy paper that I worked on. And like, how often do people do that? More than you think they do, which is fun, right? A lot of people rate that as more important for their relationships than intercourse. And we used to only talk about intercourse as the only important thing. And it turns out it's not. And that just makes me really happy to know about, right? Some other quant research that I've done is on Latina sexual health communication. That's a paper that's TBD for publication, but that's pretty exciting. And like, how do Latina young women get talked to about sexual activity versus young men? Turns out not as much, which impacts contraceptive use and impacts other use, right? So I could go on about other projects I've done, but I'm going to stop there before I take up too much space.
I so love when you talk about sex and cuddling and all these lovely and fun topics. I kind of want to say, insert salt and peppers. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you. But that would moment.
Oh, you got me. You got me dancing.
I mean, it all relates to research, right? I just so love it. I love it. I love it. So I've used numeric data from surveys for a study we were working on. I was working with two other colleagues. However, you know, we were only able to tell part of a story. And I think it's really important that, you know, the way that I approach qualitative and qualitative research is that there is a space in this world for us to coexist and understand each other. And I completely acknowledge that I will never understand quantitative fully. And that's okay. The other way I discuss the importance and relevance of qualitative research is that we discuss the lived experiences behind the numbers. And that's something that I find to be really, really important. Which brings us back to the topic for today. How does qualitative research remain relevant in a quantitative world? To really address our topic, I wanted to approach this conversation thinking about the acronym PEA, like sweet pea.
Tell me more. Why pea?
Tell me more. I just feel like singing today. I don't know why. I can't sing. So I think PEA, or sweet pea, whatever you want to say, policy, advocacy, and education. So I wanted to first start with policy.
Hold on. Before we move into sweet pea, can you tell me a little bit more about like those definitions for quant and how they make sense in your brain. Like, why did you pick those definitions? We talked about definitions a lot last episode.
We did. And I so knew you were going to ask me this question, right? So I think when I thought about this, it was really important to me. There's a lot of policies, a lot of advocacy work, a lot of education work that is fundamentally grounded in quant numbers. Like, people are always saying, show me the numbers. I mean, granted, it's not show me the money, but show, I mean, we can talk about how it's show me the money. But I think it's really important for some organizations, whether it's political, nonprofits, definitely within the educational system. And I know we talked a little bit about that, that people want numbers. However, behind those numbers are the lived experiences of humans, of people. And so if we don't understand why these numbers exist, there's really no data to support the numbers, you know. And maybe I could say that another way, and that's not the most sophisticated way to say it, but there's just not enough information. So at the end of the day, there is a space for us to coexist. It is not that I'm trying to say, oh, let's live in a happy world. And as we were talking about before our before we started recording, I was just like, I just want to say to a quant person, do you need a hug? You need a hug, don't you? Okay, so that's really what. And I feel like quantitative people look at us like, oh, you're the one that's giving out free hugs, huh? How many of you are giving out free hugs? Mind you, these are consenting hugs. When I think about this, that's how I really think about what the research that we do. We all love the research that we do. At the end of the day, we all love the research that we do. In addition to that, people want to know the numbers and they want to know the lived experiences. And again, kind of going back to at the very beginning where I was asking you and just hearing, like, asking you about, hey, what are some things that we've heard people say to us? I think I've also heard people say, prove it. Prove it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can prove it to you. So, I think when I, again, thinking about this acronym, that's really where my brain went. And then also thinking about the topic for today, you know, how can qualitative research remain relevant? That's how we remain relevant in this quantitative world. We bring that information to the forefront of policymaking. We bring that information to conversations around advocacy, and even more so discussing education. So that's really where my brain is when I think about this.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it makes me so excited to hear more about what you have thought out for us. So tell me, take me on this journey of sweet peas. And where do we start with our policy, I'm assuming, because that's the first letter of P. So sweet pea, Dr. Tiffany, tell me more.
Either sweet peas or snap peas. As a kid, I also had to sit in my grandmother's kitchen snapping peas. I don't know if that's a Southern thing or what, but.
Well, I grew up in the country, so it's also a country thing.
So let's snap some peas together, you know? So one of the policymaking. So when I think about policymaking, and again, I'm using the lens of drowning prevention, water safety, because that's where I'm rooted in. I think about the fact that in our world, we often cite the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we discuss the racial disparity in drowning deaths. So I'm going to just start, I hate to say this, but start reading to you about that. And so drowning death rates for Black people are 1.5 times higher than the rates for white people. Disparities are highest amongst Black children ages 5 to 9, rates 2.6 times higher. And rate ages between 10 to 14, rates are 3.6 times higher. So if you know, you think about that, and you're like, oh my gosh, that's so bad. That's so, so bad. And of course, like, of course it's bad. In addition to, we are often asking ourselves, so why? Why are the drowning deaths for Black people 1.5 times higher than that of white people? Now, I'm going to ask Dr. Lizzie, why do you think, just shout it out, these drowning deaths are so much higher? Just take a guess.
Well, I think back to working at summer camps in college, and I think back to a lot of the myths that would circulate. And I worked with most of my campers came from inner city New York, and they would say, like, well, I can't get my hair wet. And I would be like, yeah, that makes sense. But like, let's put on a cap on so you don't have to get your hair wet and you can still go in the water. And some of the other counselors would be like, oh no, they don't need a cap. I don't need a cap when I go in. And be like, yeah, you have different hair. Of course you don't. And some people would be like, well, I've been told I'm going to drown if I go in the water. And, or like, I can't float. And I'm like, why do you think you can't float? And they would say things like, well, I've been told that. With a 6-year-old, you're not going to unpack that too much because you can't unpack that too much. But I think about all of the myths that float around and where pools are and who has access to swimming and who doesn't. And I think that probably relates to some of that. So my brain goes straight to social determinants because of course it does. So I don't know if that's what you were looking for or not, but ask a public health person who teaches social determinants of health what they think.
You just put the J in my joy. You do. So you're absolutely positively right. You know, there are definitely other reasons as to, you know, these other social determinants. I mean, and that's a whole nother conversation for another day. If you are at the University of Buffalo, this is a quick promotion. Please sign up for Dr. Lizzie Bartelt's class if you have not already done so. So, I mean, the other part to this is just in swimming pools. Do you know any other information out there about swimming pools, Dr. Lizzie?
Do I know any other information? Like, do I know where swimming pools are located in communities? So, or do I know about, I mean, I've been around you for a lot of years, so I know some things.
So I there's a quote that I was wondering if you could just read for our lovely listeners.
In swimming pools, Black children ages 10 to 14 years drown at rates 7.6 times higher than white children. Black children and youth are more likely to drown in public schools, and white children and youth are more likely to drown in residential pools. And this comes from AJPH, to the Uninformed American Journal of Public Health, by Saluja et al. In 2006.
Thank you so much. So again, quantitative data, we love it. Yay. Thank you so much thank you so much, Dr. Lizzie, for reading that. This is really helpful information again, in terms of how of framing. So in 2020, in the text Promoting Equity, Social Justice, and Saving Lives with Life Jacket and Clothing Policy, authors Dr. Angela Beale-Taufik, aka my mentor, Linda Kwan, Elizabeth Bennett, and Roy R. Fielding wrote an amazing piece. It says right there in their abstract, policy variations around wearing clothing and swim diapers could be costly, confusing, and impede participation in aquatic activities by vulnerable populations, specifically young children and racial and ethnic minorities. Okay, so think about what we just talked about, right? The statistics. Just think about that, and now think about that sentence. So standardization of these policies could assist aquatic facilities and their users. Some numerical data the researchers gathered are from the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This study was completed by the use of a survey and the data analysis used, and I'm quoting here, simple descriptive statistics used can included frequency distributions and percentages. Now, you might be listening and asking yourself, what is the point of discussing a study that was completed using a quantitative design? My response to you is, look at the references. And to note that the researchers use exploratory data was called using a qualitative research approach, consisted of yes, no, multiple choice, and open-ended questions. So again, even this particular study relied on some qualitative data. So it's just really important to think about the fact that even quantitative researchers definitely use qualitative data, and the relevance is still there. So Lizzie, do you have an example in your research that you used qualitative research to make sense of the research that's been gathered quantitatively? I think you've talked a little bit about, I kind of am really curious about this cuddling like study, to be very frank with you, but you go ahead and talk about whatever.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I can think of a lot of examples. One that comes to mind is one of the bias studies that I did. So this is with a group of people. We were looking at bias towards bisexual individuals, both from the heterosexual community and from the gay and lesbian community. And there was a great deal of bias that was experienced on both sides, unsurprisingly. And in one study, we had an open-ended textbook to have people describe what that bias was. And we found in there, very surprisingly, an increasing number of younger people who said that they hadn't experienced any bias at all, but they'd only experienced inclusion. And we were like, oh my goodness, the world is changing. The young people are all right. They're getting along with each other. They're not having this infighting within the queer community. And like, how nice is that? It's something you and I talk about a lot, Dr. Tiffany, of like what the infighting looks like in different communities, right? And like how that can be really, really harmful to people within the community. And I'm not saying that they don't experience anything. Just in one study, from a handful of people that were younger, they had positive experiences. So that was pretty cool to be able to understand this quantitative research and trends, and to understand the qualitative aspects of it, and to understand that a little bit more specifically. Another study that comes to mind is a scary sex study. And so we asked people, have you ever had sex that felt scary to you? And then we had them write in and fill in a text box and answer that. And there was all of these stories of like what that actually meant to them. And for the men in this study, it was like, well, I was afraid she'd been with somebody else previously. And for the women in the study, it was like, there was a gun next to the bed that I knew that was going to come out if I didn't do what he wanted me to. And it wasn't always that drastic, but there were that drastic of differences, right? So like saying that both men and women experience scary sex, that is true. But the way that that fear manifests itself is very, very different.
Wow. You know what? You always amaze me. The research that you do is always it just blows my mind. It's just amazing. So the really cool part about this type of work that we do, that all of us do, but most importantly, when we're thinking about qualitative research, when I think about qualitative research, you know, is how it makes an impact on policies. So definitely thinking about not only what you discussed just a minute ago, but also what Dr. Beals and et al.'s research is the fact that these are helps with making a difference in policy. Let it be at that particular facility, let it be at the state level, which we will get to in a minute, or I'm just so excited about what we're going to get to and talking about that. But these are the beginning of conversations that can make a larger impact. So then the E, snapping those peas.
Us about the E.
Ooh, the E. So I was just recently, I was sharing with you that I just started reading S.R. Tolliver's Recovering Black Storytelling and Qualitative Research in Darkened Story Work. And the word that I put in our notes was, I am gobsmacked.
That's such a good word, and I want to know everything. Tell me so much more.
I love this. I'm just so, so excited about it. But the fact that this text is an invitation, I am going to say invitation, an invitation to hearing the words of Black girls and is always a delight. But most importantly, how this researcher does it makes me rethink even my writing and my approach to Black girls in swimming. So the reason that I wanted to discuss very briefly, and again, I feel like I'm not giving her her text justice. But the reason I wanted to discuss Tolliver's work is because one, an analysis, and again, I am quoting from another text, but analysis of the National U.S. Department of Education from 2015 to 2016, civil rights data by the National Women's Law Center and the Educational Trust or the Education Trust Fund, found that Black girls are 5 times more likely than white girls to be suspended at least once and 4 times as likely as white girls to be arrested at school. Black storytelling methods and the strategies showcase the enduring commitment of a people to nurture a unique spirituality-based culture in the midst of an oppressive environment. And that's in the preface. Can't even say the word. So I wanted to briefly read from the preface. I'm going to just recoin this term. Preface.
It's how it's spelled. If it's they want it to be spelled. Pronounced differently, spell it differently.
Exact, right? The face of all the text. There you go. It says, it was at this moment that I ran into this spiritual dilemma. When I initially conducted the study, I thought Western academic resources were required for me to be recognized as a real, quote unquote, scholar. I slipped away from Black-centered thinking, from the work of story, from myself. I forced my work into the shape of narrative research and thematic analysis, even though I was forcing myself to move away from the work of story. A revisit to this work compelled me to break open that methodological cage and seek the methods I tried to forget in order to exist in a white-dominated field. When I chose to remember, to search for the hidden methods created by my foremothers and shunned in the contemporary academic field, I realized that the methods guiding me could be subsumed under the Black historical tradition of quilting. So, the next thing that I wrote.
hold on. Before we get to that, I'm so curious. Tell me what that quote symbolizes for you. What is that representing and pulling up for you?
For me, again, I haven't delved. I'm just starting. So for me, it meant that I needed to rethink my approach to my work.
Tell me more.
And I felt that my own education had been whitewashed. And I felt that the numbers, it was the gathering of the numbers, were not symbolic of who I am. It reminds me of census data. So the census data that was collected during Jim Crow era, and it's not complete. It's not complete. So in my family, there is, on my mother's side of the family, the paternal side of my family, there's a last name, and my grandfather's last name is spelled different ways, but it's the same family, because the people collecting the data could not understand the dialect. They couldn't understand the language. They couldn't. And so, again, fast forward, like, reading this, I am like, whoa, like, we need to really connect, reconnect with who we are culturally, to put in perspective collective experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got goosebumps.
Yeah. Me too. That was really powerful. Thanks for sharing that.
I was about to say thanks for having me, but
this is as much yours as it is mine, if not more so.
And so that's a wrap, right?
Thanks for being in this space with us, you all. This is what qualitative research does.
So, I mean, just thinking about the fact that this scholar is advocating for culture. And again, quilting, you know, I don't want to get down the be like, hey, so this is what quilting is and how it's related to African-American culture. And I don't want to do that. But that is what she's referring to. And then also just collectively what she's referring to, and just so much. And again, please pick up this book, Recovering Black Storytelling and Qualitative Research in Darkened Work, Futures of Data Analysis and Qualitative Research. I feel like we've become a promotion.
We're not getting paid by any of these people.
We are not getting paid by any of these people.
We like their work, and we're going to put it in the show notes.
Definitely, definitely. But it just reminded me that, you know, reading more from that future ed org site, and actually, before I get there, you know, I just, you know, there just comes a time where we as researchers had to break away from this paradigm of how we've been educated, and what it means to be a researcher, and to truly address our and again, I'm going to use this word very liberally, research problem, even though that language is very problematic. You know, I am not a problem.
You know? Ooh. Ooh. Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh. I disrupt society as we know it, but I am not a problem.
Wait. No human being is a problem. No human being is at risk. Wait. Our language has an impact on how we think about the world and how we construct the world. Is that what you're saying? Are we going back to Bhattachary?
Oh. See, we're all connected. We're connecting it all. So, I mean, so there's just so much. There's so much. So again, it's the relevance of qualitative research in a quantitative world continues, because the information that's out there, you know, think about who is collecting that data. You may have just caught somebody on the wrong time of day. You know, you just never know. again, I want to reiterate that this forum is not staunchly advocating against quantitative research. I think, again, like I said earlier, I just want to give a quantitative researcher a consenting hug. Be like, do you need a hug, honey? Do you need a hug? Like, what? Who hurt you? Do you need a hug? I'm just simply stating that the lived experiences, and it can sometimes, emphasis on sometimes, be explained behind these numbers. So again, it's the education, and that was the whole point of me talking about this. This part is that it's the education, the importance of education behind these lived experiences. So we already talked about P, policymaking. Yeah. And yeah. E, the education. All right, let's snap that P.
We're getting to the last part of our sweet P, Dr. Tiffany. Okay. Take us there.
So on April Fool's Day, 2022, the House of Representatives passed a bill banning race-based discrimination on hair known as the Crown Act. So if anybody knows anything about black hair, this is our crown. This is our jewel, our gem. It's symbolic, but I'm not going to give you a history lesson. Thank goodness for Google, which is not paying for this podcast. So discussing two studies very, very briefly, and ironically, these two people were doing the work together. The two studies are intersectionality, connecting experiences of gender with race at work, and the natural hair bias in job recruitment. The researchers from Michigan State and then one of the other researchers from Duke, they talk about these lived experiences that African-American women face. And again, I'm just quoting from the abstracts of both of these, face the highest instances of hair discrimination. They're more likely to be sent home from the workplace because of their hair. The study also determined that 80% of African-American women felt they needed to switch their hairstyle to align with a more conservative standards in order to fit in at work. I will openly admit, I have locks now, but I will say that as soon as I graduated from undergrad, I relaxed my hair. I know you cannot imagine that, Dr. Lizzie, but I did relax my hair once.
I mean, I can imagine you doing any number of things because you've told me about a lot of the different number of hair choices you've had over the years. And I'm sure I've told you about some of my hair choices. Hair is such an important piece for all of our identities.
It's, but this was my crown, you know,
Yeah.
And so, there was one time I was teaching swim lessons and I definitely did not have a relaxed look. I was all my natural hair. And my former supervisor said to me, what are you going to do with that? Yes.
No.
True story. She said this to me.
She was white, wasn't she?
She was. She was. I also do not need people to come on and say, this is an anti-white podcast. We are covering all of our bases here. But, you know, so that has happened to me. I mean, granted, that was now 27 years ago. Wait, how old am I? 23 years ago. No, I'm not 47, but 23 years ago. And so having said that, that happened to me and I did relax my hair. And that was also the last time I relaxed my hair. In another study, the researchers talked about that they found black women with natural hairstyles were perceived to be less professional, less competent, and less likely to be recommended for a job interview than black women with straightened hairstyles and white women with either curly or straight hairstyles. So we have two different studies. One that you can tell is definitely quant. And the other one, it's definitely, you can definitely say here the qualitative parts to it. Again, other people are citing these studies. And because of their research, we now have the Crown Act. So this is now, this is the A, the advocacy for this type of work. It's just a beautiful thing. You know, so again, I definitely want to go back to the fact that we can coexist, quantitative and qualitative people, researchers, we can coexist in this world. And that's okay. It really, really is okay. it's just is a beautiful thing. So again, the relevance of the type of work that we do, it makes an impact on society as we know it, as we know it. So yeah, that there's our snap pea or sweet pea.
We made it all the way back through. So
we made it all the way back through. We made it all the way back through. But Dr. Lizzie, do you want to add anything? I'm just so excited about this.
I love it. I love this journey you've taken us on and helping us think through how qualitative research is really relevant for policy, education, and advocacy. And I hear all of that. And I think all of those are super duper important. And I guess my big question for you is, having taken us on this journey and having thought through all of these different pieces, for you, what do you want to say to the qualitative researcher who is hearing a lot like, oh, well, your research isn't as rigorous or your research isn't as important as the numbers? Like, what do you want that person to hear?
My immediate response is to the haters out there. I feel like I'm about ready to DJ. To the haters out there who don't believe in qualitative research, don't worry, we'll show you love. We're gonna heal the research world. Ooh. That's totally my that's my DJ response, right? I think what I really want to do is for that qualitative researcher who doesn't feel uplifted in this world, because you and I both know what it feels like to be in a space that is heavy quant, but we went to a school, again, we are not bashing where we went to, but we went to an institution that is a school that is heavily reliant upon quantitative research. And
let's also note that was while we were there.
It was.
It may have changed.
It was when we were there. It was when we were there. Yes. So coming out of it, I think find your core, find your group of people. FYI, I do think that using the language of finding your tribe is problematic. So just letting you know, that's the reason why I'm not using those words. But find your core, find your group of people, find your family. I think that's what's going to be really, really important so that you can develop as a stronger qualitative researcher and dig deep. I really believe in writing what you believe and writing what, and researching with people. Just think about who you are and how you want to connect with this research area. But again, if people are hating on what you do, be like, do you need a hug? Like, I feel like that needs to be a sticker. Do you need a hug? Who hurt you? I mean, Dr. Lizzie, could you imagine if we had done that to certain people at school? At school, be like, do you need a hug?
I mean, I have a sense that wouldn't have gone over well all of the time.
It probably would not have gone over well. But I mean, like, just be confident. Be confident in what you're doing. Read. Ask questions. Be inquisitive. There was something that you said earlier. Qualitative research asks the what and the what.
The how and the why.
The how and the why. Continue to push for that how and the why. And then ask the person if they need a consenting hug.
I love it. I love it so much.
What do you want to tell people as we wrap up?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think what I would say to the qualitative researcher who's hearing a lot of your work isn't as valid type questions, because really that's what's at the root of those questions, is to say to people, what I often say to people when I feel like they're being really dismissive or erasing of who I am, I say, why is it that you think that? Because usually they have been taught that from somebody, either explicitly or implicitly. And so I like to try to help them peel those layers away and say, like, okay, well, let me give you a for instance. For instance, I was just filling out a survey about a month ago, real story, not me making something up, that I got sent by through work channels, let's just say. And they were asking me questions of like, how satisfied are you with the way you hear information about XYZ? And it was like sent from another institution that was doing some kind of survey in conjunction. I don't know, lots of different pieces. Doesn't really matter why it came out. But I was thinking as I was filling that out, like, well, as I'm putting it, like my answer into this Likert type scale, my understanding of strongly agree with this question is a very different than my colleague who's right next door to me's understanding of strongly agree, because we've had conversations about this and I know our interpretation of this question is going to be vastly different. And so like helping people understand that not everyone responds in the same way to those Likert type scale questions. And of course, that's not all of quantitative research. We both understand that. But I think what we're both honing in on and what we both get really frustrated by is erasure or dismissal. And so if somebody is saying that to you, help them understand that that is what they are saying to you. They might not ever be using those words, but often that is where those questions or dismissal of qualitative research comes from. So I think that's what I would say.
I appreciate you saying that. I the other thing, as we, again, I know I said as we wrap up, but I we were talking about this very, very briefly. And possibly some of the reasons why quantitative researchers want to express their feelings towards qualitative researchers negatively. And it is not saying that this is for all. But there is an amount of stress associated to, and we were talking about publication, the amount of stress related to the reliability and validity of their information, and that we don't have to go through as much as we talked about before, rigor. I am doing air quotes, rigor. And that in turn, and again, I am quoting Dr. Lizzie, that in turn could challenge the fact that whether or not they get funding. So I feel like there are almost some people are pushing their challenges upon us. On the flip side, as a qualitative researcher, we are just having to justify why we belong in the academy, why we need funding, why we are doing what we're doing. So I think there's a battle of the researchers. A battle to be seen, a battle to be heard. So yeah, I think particularly as students, you know, we're often caught in the middle of these battles. And like, this is not for y'all tenure people. Y'all need to work that out. Again, they need a hug. They need to work it out. Work it out amongst yourselves. You know, but anyway, we can continue going on. Dr. Lizzie, thank you so much. Just thank you.
Well, thank you. I loved this journey you took us on in helping us understand why qualitative research remains relevant in a quantitative world. Thank you for doing all of this work and taking us on this sweet pea journey. I loved it. All about policy education and advocacy, you all. Any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
No, I mean, again, y'all aren't going to look at peas the same way after this.
All right. Until next time.
Until next time, friend.
All right. Color outside those memos, and we will see you in the next episode.
See you then.
The
This episode of Coloring Outside the Memos has been brought to you by Dr. Lizzie Bartelt and Dr. Tiffany Monique Quash. Transcripts were edited by Shada Barzargani. The editor, website designer, and our producer is Lindsay Studer. Our graphic designers are Teddy Gabrielli and Gas Delister. This podcast is supported to you by American University's Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, cheers.